Kanga?
Here.
Representative Petry is excused. Representative Taylor is excused. Senator Wirch?
Here.
Ms. Carlson?
Here.
Mr. Cross?
Here.
Mr. Gebhardt will be here this afternoon. Mr. Jasky is excused. Ms. Claycamp? Judge Levine is excused. Ms. Stevens? Ms. Thompson?
Here.
Judge Trigiano is excused, and Mr. Wapus.
Here. Thank you. We have a new person, legislative counsel, joining us today, Melissa Schmidt. We'll take him Chad's place. And Melissa, you want to introduce yourself to the group a little bit?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Melissa Schmidt. I've been with the Ledge Council for about 6 years now, and I normally staff criminal justice related committees, consumer protection related committees, municipal law, like urban local affairs. So I kind of dabble in a lot of different things, but I'm looking forward to working with you, and thank you for serving on this committee.
Thank you. If you've had a chance to look at the minutes for the July 22nd meeting, looking for a motion for approval or correction if needed. We have a second? Okay. Motion has been made to approve and it's been seconded the July 22nd minutes. All in favor? Any opposed? Thank you. First presentation will be by Judge Melissa White Eagle, Ho-Chunk Nation Trial Court. Good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Well, first I'd like to say good morning to everyone. My name is Amanda White Eagle. I am the Associate Judge for the Ho-Chunk Nation Trial Court. I have served in that capacity since 2006. I'm a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Law School. Class of 2005. I also serve as a Jackson County Court Commissioner up in Jackson County, Wisconsin. Again, I'd just like to thank you for inviting me here to speak. Our Healing to Wellness Court is relatively new. It is approximately 2.5 years old. So understandably, it's a little newer than perhaps some of the other Wisconsin drug courts or similar DUI courts. So what I intend to do today is to provide you with some information from a tribal perspective. Presumably, that's why I was invited today, is to explain some of what our Healing to Wellness Courts provide to our tribal members currently in Jackson County. There are some subtle nuances that are going to be differences for perhaps our sister jurisdictions in Wisconsin. Primarily because Wisconsin is a public law 280 state. We do not exercise criminal jurisdictions currently at this time. So I'm going to be explaining this throughout my presentation. And if you have any questions, I don't know if you want me to reserve time at the end or if you wish to intervene. Either is fine with me. What I've provided you with today is a copy of the Ho-Chunk Nation Healing to Wellness Court Participant Handbook. Within that handbook, we note what our mission statement is for our Healing to Wellness Court. We, meaning the tribe, created the Healing Wellness Court to address alcohol and drug abuse in our community and its associated consequences with the criminal justice system. We act in partnership with several tribal and as well as communal agencies and service providers to achieve goals, and we've set those out to restore traditional values, mores, and languages, and as well as create support systems and foster employment within our community, maintain relationships and resources to continually assist our participants. We focus on restorative justice along with collaborative decision making. The Ho-Chunk Nation currently does not have a tribal criminal code, which would impede the Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Justice and the Law Enforcement Division from fully executing its duties and responsibilities. So I'm sure you're wondering, well then, how is it that we exercise jurisdiction over these matters? We have a partnership with Jackson County currently. They provide a lot of the subject matter jurisdiction, meaning that when an individual is charged and convicted, Jackson County will, to a limited extent, transfer jurisdiction in order for our court to monitor our Ho-Chunk Nation participants. So the county treatment court determines whether an individual may participate in its existing program. So Jackson County has its Jackson County Drug Court. And then they can also decide whether a Ho-Chunk participant may have his or her case monitored by the Tribal Wellness Court. Currently, we are monitoring 8 participants. Three of those are female participants. The rest are male participants. Currently, a majority of them have alcohol-related offenses, and there are a few with drug-related offenses. And we've created separate tracks for those individuals in order to ensure sobriety. The Wellness Court exercises independent discretion in monitoring the assigned cases. So again, contained within our participant handbook, we have our own guidelines that are utilized to, again, match with our mission statement to ensure that we're restoring traditional values and cultural concerns. So we use all the resources that we have available within the Ho-Chunk Nation, which includes mental health, counseling, the Verna program, and I'll get a little bit more in depth in that in a moment. But we also rely upon the county, and we rely upon the county again for probation, policing, and imprisonment if necessary. So I know you have heard before about incentives and sanctions, and a really powerful sanction is incarceration. We don't use it for a period of to extend past 4 days, but we have used it on occasion dependent upon the offense that has been committed. We monitor participants as they proceed through 4 phases of our program. We've divided it into 4 phases, which is similar to some of the other jurisdictions. We call them Wingus Chuni, Wingus Noop, Wingus Dani, and Wingus Joe. That's our language. Chuni, Noop, Dani, and Jope are the numbers, and Wingus is sort of like a time frame. So we do recognize that they're going to be going through different phases, and each different phase, when you look through our participant handbook, you can see that each phase has different requirements depending on where you are at in the program. A variety of conditions, incentives, and punishments are present in each phase. So one of the challenges I believe that exist for tribal communities is Public Law 280. And in 1953, Congress gave 5 and then later 6 states extensive criminal and civil jurisdiction over Indian country. And this was done in the 1950s primarily due to a sense of lawlessness in Indian country. I think a small irony here is that Public Law 280 was essentially enacted because the Western community didn't agree with some of the restorative justice models that were utilized by tribes at the time. So now that we're using restorative justice, I just find it to be sort of an irony. When Public Law 280 was enacted, there was one tribe in the state of Wisconsin that was exempt from that, and that's the Menominee Nation, because at that time they were terminated and later regained federal recognition, and during that time frame they weren't a subject to Public Law 280. So just a little background about the other tribes in the state of Wisconsin. Of the 11 federally recognized tribes, 3 of those tribes have healing to wellness courts or drug courts. It's the Ho-Chunk Nation, along with the Menominee Nation, and most recently, Lac du Flambeau. So they all have, and we're realizing as tribal communities that this is really becoming a source of pride, I think, for tribal courts. And the reason why I say that, and I know you've heard speakers here before, but as the associate judge, I find this to be probably the most enjoyable part of my job. Because you see the effects of, I mean, I can find people and they can go away and I never see them again. They may or may not recommit. But having this investment in our community has been really powerful, and I think other tribes are actually recognizing that as well. The Menominee tribe has had their drug court in existence for a longer period of time than the Ho-Chunk Nation. The Lac du Flambeau tribe is more recent than the Ho-Chunk Nation, and Forest County Potawatomi, I believe, should have their healing to wellness court in place within the next year or so. But really causing tribes to invest in their communities. So whereas the state of Wisconsin, you certainly, as for particular counties, want to encourage drug courts or healing to wellness courts or whatever they may be called, because there's a huge cost savings, not only for incarceration, but for services, etc. But in fact, with tribal communities, we're keeping our tribal members in our community, meaning that they aren't going to prison, they aren't going to jail, they're able to participate in our program, and we're able to provide them with services, including but not limited to mental health, but then also find employment. I live in rural Wisconsin, Jackson County, and specifically Black River Falls. There's not a lot of job opportunities there, but we've been extremely successful in employing our tribal member participants. This slide just deals with why Public Law 280 was enacted, which I briefly touched upon. So you've heard me reference Jackson County quite a bit. As you're aware, the Ho-Chunk Nation has lands throughout the state of Wisconsin, as well as in Illinois. This map just shows where those lands are. You can see that it's in Jackson County, Monroe County, Sauk County, Juneau County, Shawano County, as well as Wood County. So we have tribal members and tribal trust land throughout the state of Wisconsin. So why is it right now that we're only working with Jackson County? Primarily right now it is a pilot project. The Ho-Chunk Nation legislature is looking into expanding that, but recognizing that there are some costs with that. We have a very strict model that I believe is effective, but we don't allow out-of-county travel for the first phase. We're trying to get stabilization set. And these are all concerns that the legislature needs to consider, whether or not we're going to purchase an RV and have a court throughout the state of Wisconsin, or whether or not we're going to require everybody to come to Black River Falls, whether we're going to have video conferencing in order to adequately monitor our participants. And this is very time intensive for us. Not to completely jump around, but if you look throughout our handbook, we have a list on the back of all of our team members, and this is pursuant to the Ho-Chunk Nation's Judiciary Act. We meet every other Wednesday, but we staff every Wednesday. And the people that we included on our staffing is our coordinator, which is a tribally funded individual. We have our defense advocate, who is attorney William Gardner. We have a special prosecutor, which is employed by our Ho-Chunk Nation Department of Justice, attorney Mackie Wallander. We have two treatment counselors, one that deals primarily with alcohol and drug abuse, and then the other one with mental health because of all the co-occurring disorders that exist with our participants. We have our Ho-Chunk Nation Police Department, the State of Wisconsin Probation Agent, our traditional court member, our compliance officer who does a majority of the testing, the VERNA program, which I had referenced earlier, which is the Vocational Rehabilitation for Native Americans. We have our legislative representative on there, and then they're required to have a sponsor. So every week we staff our participants with our group to determine what is going on with the individual, what services are needed, and then try to incorporate our culture and our concerns with some of our participants. But recognizing, again, that it is time-intensive because we have so many other individuals that have other concerns. So the only person that is dedicated to solely working on our Healing to Wellness Court is our court coordinator and our treatment counselors, because it's so, again, time-intensive. A point that I was attempting to make is that we need to ensure that our key components are met. The tribe has adopted the 10 key components, which are addressed through NADCP, the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. We haven't adopted the entirety of the Wisconsin Association of Treatment Court Professionals, but we've incorporated them in other ways with our participant handbook and the like. We attempt to have immediate intervention. If they can successfully move from arrest or other court action, we will typically have our participants go directly into an in-treatment program or inpatient treatment program. And that has been best practices for high-risk, high-need individuals. I put this in here because I thought it was interesting, because when we first started, we believed that voluntary entrance meant that, you know, you really wanted to get well. We found that that's not necessarily the case. Sometimes people want to voluntarily enter our program, not necessarily because they need help, but because they don't want to go to prison. And I've said, you know, I appreciate your honesty. I'd welcome you to be a part of our program, because honesty is the number one rule that we have in treatment court. And then participants with accountability is an important piece to recovery and success. And we've had the opportunity to travel to different conferences. I think we're one of the few teams in the state that has received grant funding, and we've taken, with the support of from our tribe, all of our participants have attended national training, or all of our team members, rather, have attended national training, which is virtually unheard of. And every year we go to the Wisconsin Association of Treatment Court Professionals. And this is due in large part because of our desire and our concern to stay on top of the best practices, and the best evidence-based practices are often shown at those national trainings. The Healing to Wellness Court program has short-term goals for individuals as well as long-term goals for individuals. They do meet regularly, and we have a team setup where team members are allowed to speak as well, but ultimately all of the judgment comes from myself as the judge. And I'll have the final decision making on all of the either sanctions or incentives. We have only had one individual graduate from our program. And like I said, we've been in existence now for approximately 2.5 years. We've had a number of people that were unable to complete our program. Some had to be terminated from our program and went to prison. And others were released from our program due to perhaps some of the concerns that we have as a court, the inability to assist individuals with severe mental health needs. Again, rural Wisconsin does not have a huge draw for psychologists, psychiatrists. This is oftentimes something that is taken outside of our county. But the commencement is very intensive. The weeks are a long period of time. We've had people that we've released from our program who have remained sober. And in my mind, although they didn't officially graduate, I consider that a success. So of people that we've released, I believe that 4 of the 5 remain sober. So who is eligible? Currently, we assist individuals who are members of the Ho-Chunk Nation who are 18 years or older. Proposed participants, it has a pre-plea crossed out. That's because we did determine that we would need the state of Wisconsin in terms of the Department of Corrections to assist us. So we only accept participants that are post-adjudication at this particular time. They need to agree to abide by our rules. They must meet the diagnostic criteria for substance abuse dependency. The team has to consider the prior criminal offenses. In order to determine its eligibility determinations, and currently they need to be a resident of Jackson County. We have certainly the capacity to accept additional participants. A huge roadblock for us has been the definition of a violent offender. We've learned at national training that those are the individuals that you really need to help, and we've seen some statistical analysis that would indicate that they have violent offenders being just as much of a chance for success as nonviolent offenders. But we have individuals that have applied that have been charged with a violent felony, not even convicted, and that has been a stumbling block. I believe we've turned away somewhere between 7 and 11 individuals based upon that criteria. Referrals can come from the arresting agency, the district attorney's office, the defense attorney, or the probation agent, in this case, the Department of Corrections. Again, this goes through our treatment team and what the makeup of that is. Just to sort of back up a little bit and explain a little bit about the Ho-Chunk Nation judiciary, currently we have a trial court, one appellate court, which is our Ho-Chunk Nation Supreme Court. There are two JD graduates that serve as attorneys that are judges for the tribe, and currently all three of the appellate justices are law trained as well. They have JDs from various schools throughout the United States. We have a traditional court, and I know that in here it references a traditional court member. Those are made up of our clan elders who are male and fluent in the Ho-Chunk language. Traditional court hears matters that involve tradition and custom, so not necessarily written laws, but to the extent that anything needs to be adjudicated, it then comes to the trial court for recognition. We have our Healing to Wellness Court, and recently the tribe, along with Jackson County, did receive a grant for a family Healing to Wellness Court, and so that is in its infancy stages right now. So the makeup of the judiciary itself consists of five courts. The Family Treatment Court is very similar in terms of its makeup as to who is a part of the Healing to Wellness Court. And the different representatives, specifically VRNA, the Vocational Rehabilitation of Native American, and the Traditional Court, just ensure that we are incorporating culture into our court system. So my role as the judge is I participate fully in all of the staffing and the court sessions. I work as a partner with my team to ensure that we have success. There have been times that I've disagreed with the team, but ultimately it's been my decision. I've learned a long time ago in this job you can't make everybody happy, and I understand that sometimes it's not even my own team members, but I believe that I follow our participant handbook, ensure due process, and ensure that everybody's treated fairly. In terms of effective incentives and sanctions, I found that dependent upon the participant, for instance, if you lie about something in order to get out of going to group, and you do that consistently, that is going to be a progressively sanctionable event that will lead to some type of jail time. I have one participant that I'm pretty sure he could do jail standing on his head. He's like, oh, three meals, a place to sleep? Yeah, send me to jail. That's great. So I found something different that works with him, which is community service. Who knew someone could hate community service as much as this particular individual? So you really have to look at our participants and be like, well, what works for you? What doesn't work for you? We have participants that, for one reason or another, have sort of lost their way, meaning that they don't consider themselves Ho-Chunk. They're enrolled Ho-Chunk, but they consider themselves Indian. And they don't want to learn about our culture. I certainly can't force somebody's culture upon them, but we offer different options for that individual. And sometimes we'll provide meetings with the traditional court or the clan mothers so that they know what clan they come from. We've been, again, in phase three requiring language classes. And that's just across the board. If you agree to be a part of our program, you have to agree to participate in some of our cultural concerns. I have had a learning curve when it comes to addiction, alcoholism, and pharmacology. I certainly don't want to be known as the judge that's a social worker or the judge that's attempts to be a professional psychologist. I rely upon my team members for that. I ask appropriate questions and make sure that I'm not overextending my bounds. Additional portion is that I need to be aware of the impacts of substance abuse on the court system, which I think is a large part of why we have the family treatment court starting. It doesn't just affect one person, but it affects the family and then the larger community. And I think that we've seen that in terms of parents becoming sober and then all of a sudden wanting to be a parent. And then you have a child that says, look, you haven't been around for the past 4 years. I'm 15 now. I really don't need you anymore. And kind of dealing with some of the concerns about sobriety and what impact that has on individuals. The program rules are contained within the participant handbook. I don't feel as though I need to read them out loud to you. Just that we require individuals to make certain adjustments. A lot of our program participants, they don't have a good sense of understanding about how to speak to people in authority. So we certainly have worked with our participants to understand, like, this is a different situation. This is a collaborative effort. We're trying to assist you, and we expect you to assist us. They need to attend court on time, ensuring that they don't frequent areas that have alcohol sold or served, which, again, in rural Wisconsin is quite difficult. They need to maintain their residence in Jackson County, not violate the law. We've required our participants who obtain jobs to give 2 weeks' notice. I didn't think I needed to make that a rule. I thought that's what people would do when they no longer wanted to have employment, that they'd give appropriate notice of time, but that's not the case. So we need to make sure that everything's updated. People change their cell phone numbers, it seems like every week. You need to keep it up to date so that we can keep in contact with you. So a lot of these program rules are considering what we need to do in order to keep in touch with our participant. We also have testing, which is a huge portion of our budget. It seems every time we go to national training, we come back and we think, boy, you know, we need to do this more or that more. We currently have urinalysis testing for our different phases on certain days, and then we also incorporate randomized testing. We also do PBTs. Those are primarily randomized. And then on occasion, we send in for a full panel. We had a participant that was maintaining sobriety, not passing all of the tests, but you could just tell that individual was just a little bit off. When we sent in the full panel, we discovered that the individual was utilizing K2, which wouldn't come up on our panel. And that's stuff that is always changing in terms of its chemical makeup. So we do have our compliance department, who is very knowledgeable about different testing procedures and stays on the forefront of that testing. And so we just ensure that we are testing regularly. Our program is at least 18 months long. We do have a fee for that. That at any point in time they can opt out of the program, but that would ensure that they would return to the county and fulfill their incarceration or whatever it was that they were facing in terms of probation and parole. But that's expected. Now, I told you we had been in existence for 2.5 years. That participant wasn't, our first three participants, one was discharged, one absconded, and then the other one opted out. So the our final participant, or the graduating participant rather, was able to complete the program in less than 18 months. Just an example of some of the sanctions that we utilize. We've done everything from public courtroom apologies to GPS systems. We have had scram bracelets in the past. We are looking into providing that to our participants, but at this time we don't have a contract in place. Depending on the type of sanctionable event, we have had thinking reports. We've never utilized phased demotion, but we've done increased treatment, community service, and then we have incorporated some cultural items. Pounding ash or cutting down trees for teepee poles and cleaning teepee poles. We found that that's probably one sanction that's probably more enjoyable because it's incorporating our culture and hasn't really been considered a sanction, actually. We have them visit with the traditional court or the clan mothers. And again, neither of those groups prefers that we utilize that as a sanction. And so I've said that, you know, we're not necessarily thinking that sanctions are always negative. They can also be therapeutic in nature. And what we're trying to do is discourage some behavior that is either criminal in nature or would take you back to your substance abuse or any type of addiction. We have had one person say, you know, I've asked participants before, what do you believe would be an appropriate sanction for this type of conduct? And I get everything from nothing to, well, I'd like to do 90 and 90. And I was just floored. I was like, who suggests that on behalf of themselves other than somebody who, you know, wants to get better? So we have had one person actually invoke the 90 and 90. So going to 90 AA meetings in 90 days. So that means every day you're at an AA meeting. So in terms of cultural participation, we try to ensure that our participants, based upon what it is they want to learn, would have access to these different items. Learning about everything from picking mahinch, which is milkweed. We utilize it for a type of soup. Helping with the community garden, to basket weaving, to attending a sweat lodge. We try to ensure that they have access to these items. And if they wish to leave county for a cultural reason, we staff that on a case-by-case basis, and we typically will allow that. Are there any questions today?
Do you have, or do you feel that anybody is not participated because they don't trust the system?
No. You know, I've had one participant that said that they would prefer to attend Jackson County. And when pushed upon that, being, you know, well, why would you prefer the county as opposed to the tribe? And they didn't really have a clear answer. But then they met with a team member one-on-one afterwards, and that team member relayed the fact that we would know more about what was going on in the community than Jackson County would.
Personally, what do you what has been your biggest challenge in running this court?
The biggest challenge that I've personally faced is trying to determine what failure is. You know, you want people so badly to graduate the program, and when they don't, I think it's taken quite personal. Other issues, kind of what I highlighted earlier, knowing that there are people that we could be helping that we can't because we receive grant funds. Knowing that because they're considered a violent offender, when something occurred back in the 1980s, and here we are in 2014, and we have to go back that far and say, I'm sorry, you've been charged with a violent felony. We can't assist you. And I would say, during this timeframe, just in Jackson County alone, we've had, I would say, close to 20 applicants. And of that, we've only been able to bring in a little over half, so maybe 12, 13. And so those are other, all those other individuals, they were screened out because we couldn't help.
Go ahead.
Perhaps you could be specific with us. I know you mentioned during your presentation that you got a grant to work with families and other grants. If you could tell us how much money you got, where you got it from, and how you're using it.
In terms of where we get it, in terms of with the families, I'm actually not the Family Healing to Wellness Court judge. I'm the backup judge for that. But I can get a copy of that grant and certainly provide it to Ms. Rose for the purposes of the committee. Where we've utilized that money, we've utilized it for defense counsel. Because the nation does not have a criminal code, we're not required yet to have public defenders. And so we've paid for that through grant money, so we pay an attorney to come in and make sure that due process rights are being adhered to. We also use those funds to attend a national training. We attended it 2 years ago in Washington, D.C., and last year in California, which is a huge expense, especially given the size of our team. We also have alternates, and we want to ensure that our alternates are also have the clear understanding of what's needed in terms of court participation. We also use those funds to employ our coordinator. Currently, she's covered under the grant, as well as one of our mental health clinicians.
Thank you.
Dale, did you have one?
Yeah. First of all, thank you. I really loved your presentation. I think it's so strong.
Do you have any data as far as, I know it's not a big population, so it's kind of hard, but do you have any data like your recidivism rate or other metrics that compares your program recidivism to the county?
Not that compares to the county. We certainly maintain our own data, and you're right. We have very little in terms of, because we're such a
small population, yeah.
Compared to the county's been in operation now for several years. And I don't have that data with me.
Okay.
So again, something that I can certainly have our coordinator pull up and forward on to Ms. Rose.
What's your intuition? Like, is your intuition, and first of all, I mean, I'd say that, and I've said this before on this study committee, that it's personal first. It's changing lives first, so I don't let my accounting metrics deviate from what's really important. But just, you know, anecdotally and your intuition, I mean, do you feel like what you're doing here probably saves money in the long run as far as, you know, spending all these resources now on alternatives as opposed to incarcerate? I mean, have you looked at that? I mean, what's your sense for that? Do you have a suggestion how you would measure that?
Undoubtedly, I believe that in the long term we're going to be saving money and lives. The real item we're seeing in terms of families is keeping a parent in the lives of a child. Oftentimes, mm-hmm. I mean, with Native populations, you're going to look towards something like historical trauma and what's caused individuals to be removed from home,
mm-hmm.
In their boarding schools or the like, and what they've done upon return. And sometimes it's turned to alcohol or drugs, which then leads to children turning to alcohol or drugs. You know, I also am one of the juvenile judges, so I handle all the children in need of protective services. And I would say the parents of those children, we have a very high rate that the reason for the abuse or neglect is linked to alcohol or drugs.
Thanks.
Kelly?
Thank you.
And thank you very much for your presentation. It was very interesting. And you may have mentioned it, and I missed it. Did you mention a number of how many might actually graduate from the program?
Right. We've only had one graduate. and that was recent. Right now, I think we have about 3 or 4 individuals that are on track to graduate, so we're definitely moving forward with that. We've had some issues with moving people through our program and trying to determine, you know, we go to a national conference, you'll say, sometimes people can fail at treatment, you know, 10, 13 times. And so when people say, you know, I'm not ready for phase two yet, I have a hard time saying, well, we need you to be ready for phase two because we need these numbers in order for the legislature, our tribe's legislature, to take this program seriously. And that's something that I think the whole team has grappled with. But sometimes when individuals aren't ready, we allow them to take another time frame. The issue becomes then, they're like, well, I just saw my colleague graduate, and I'm still in phase two. Like, what's possible? What's going on here? And we're like, well, it's really going to be the impetus is on you. We've had a joke, too, that people prefer to stay in our program because our incentives are so awesome. And I think that's a really core idea. But, you know, our incentives, we do use some of our grant money for that, as well as for some of our tribal funds for that. We have quarterly drawings, and people will receive things like an Xbox Connect, trying to get them, you know, involved with their family. They'll receive bicycles and helmets. And then, you know, everything from like a laundry basket full of toiletries to, you know, gift cards. So I'm not saying that that's the reason why people stay, but a lot of times people get green cards. I didn't explain this earlier. So the way our incentives are given out is if someone does something positive in our community, they get a green card. A green card will then be issued by a team member, so someone that sees somebody do something that's positive within their program rules. That will then be put in a basket, and then we have different community members who come that will pull out of the basket and give the incentive. We also have, you know, times of the year, we try to do it at least once every 3 months, where we encourage our participants to bring their family. And you would think that that would be really simple, but it's not always the case. A lot of times family members have their own addiction issues and don't want to be a part of the court system, so something that we've been dealing with as well.
Just one follow-up question. Can you talk a little bit about the restorative justice part? I know restorative justice is, but you haven't heard that so much in some of the other courts. I can hear what your court does with restorative justice.
We try to make sure that when they've perpetuated some type of wrong within our community, that they're giving back to our community. So if they were charged with 7th DUI in Jackson County, their community service could include dealing with some type of victims, not necessarily their own victim, but just sort of hearing, talking in the community. We've had some of our participants go back into the community and say, look, I started drinking alcohol when I was 9 years old. I am now 26 and I'm a part of this healing to wellness court. I need to tell you the reason why you shouldn't start drinking. We have them go to the middle school if they're eligible to go to the middle school. Now, some of the felonies that are committed disallow that to occur. But we ensure that they're providing the community with a perspective. Because it's okay for me to get up and say, look, everybody, you shouldn't drink and drive. You know, people are like, well, she doesn't know what I'm going through. That's going to be their perspective. Oftentimes when you have participants that they're known in the community, they've been drinking, if they go and speak to people, it's a lot more powerful. They're recognized for the hurdles that they've overcome.
Any other questions? Troy?
Thank you. You've mentioned the violent offender issue where you've had to turn people away because of the past. What types of offenses or what restrictions do you have on offenses that you accept getting rid of the violent offender history? What types of offenses do you accept? It's
sure.
Obviously delineated, you have to have a drug or an alcohol issue, but that can be there and not be necessarily related to the offense that somebody's charged with.
Right. So like 6th, 7th, 8th DUI, those are definitely individuals that we would admit.
Yeah.
In terms of other offenses, if there's a disorderly conduct that was based upon some type of alcohol, That would be considered a misdemeanor charge.
What about like a theft to support a drug habit?
Yes.
Okay. So you're not really restrictive on necessarily one type of offense. You'll accept them as long as they meet the other criteria?
Correct.
Okay. And then you'd mentioned that you only take them from Jackson County and they have to be Jackson County residents? Would there be any possibility of accepting someone, let's say, who lived in a neighboring county and met all other criteria and would be able to come in and do this?
Right. So going back to how it's currently organized through the Ho-Chunk Nation, there's I believe that there's an MOU in place that predates me between Jackson County and the Ho-Chunk Nation. Now, if there was that same ability in perhaps a different county, that's something that we could take on a case-by-case basis, but this currently are what our rules say. The tribe's legislature is working on a healing and wellness court code. But let's say Monroe County, right, because they've got a drug court. Let's say in Monroe is Toma, which is like a half hour from Black River Falls. And they, again, to your example of a theft to support a drug habit, it would be really up to myself as the associate judge or the chief judge of our tribe to work with Monroe County Circuit Court to say, okay, we're a public law 280 state. We don't have criminal jurisdiction. Would you want us to monitor this individual in our tribal court system? And then there's going to be some other issues. How are they going to get to court? A majority of our participants don't have driver's license. Would we as a tribe be able to take somebody and bring them back and forth? I don't know if our budget would currently support it. But, you know, again, I think that it's a real something we need to explore in terms of even video conferencing to ensure that we have adequate supervision over our participants.
Well, then going back to the Jackson County issue, since you're not the one that controls the sentence at all, you're just doing the supervising. They go ahead, plead, and get convicted in Jackson County, but then agree to participate in your program. I guess I'm missing the connection. Does Jackson County then just secede jurisdiction for the time while they're dealing with you? And if you send them back, then Jackson County has them back. If you graduate them, then they're done?
Sentence is withheld, yeah.
Okay.
And then would be forgiven.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, go ahead, please. Then Michael.
Am I on here? Okay. I was concerned, I guess, you mentioned that the majority of your participants have failed out of the program due to their mental health issues. Is that correct?
Some of them have.
Yeah.
For instance, most recently we had to release someone from our program due to their mental health needs and whether or not we would be able to adequately supervise that particular individual with their mental health needs.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that not having adequate resources for mental health treatment has been an impediment to success?
This is the first time it's occurred.
It is, okay.
I mean, if other individuals, because the period of sobriety is often very short,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times these mental health issues aren't able to materialize until a significant period of time has elapsed. With this particular individual, we found those mental health issues right away, and the individual didn't qualify for inpatient treatment, and there was a lot of lying and deception, and we weren't able to determine how that occurred. So with that particular individual, we did have to release him from the program.
And I have one more question. You mentioned, too, that alcohol seems to be the predominant drug of choice. Do you have access to medication-assisted treatment?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We haven't had to utilize it this time. We've had one tribal member that did utilize it. And I'm drawing a blank at the name of it.
Was it Vivitrol by any chance? Was it Vivitrol?
Yes,
or?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We have had one tribal member that has utilized that. But we're finding that once sobriety is attained, the addictive portion of the personality will then reach out to other drugs. So then it's I haven't been drinking, but I've even started a smoking habit. I've been abusing prescribed medication, so different items kind of spreading out. So we've had some concerns. We've definitely had relapses, but our concern is just to ensure that we have appropriate testing to ensure, you know, and a lot of times people get really defensive. I'm mm-hmm. like, look, you know, you can say that I'm an alcohol abuser, but, you know, to say that I'm a drug addict, that's just not right. Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, we have to recognize that there's a chance that you could relapse to something other than your drug of choice.
And as treatment, what's your source of funding for their treatment?
It's both the tribe and then the it's the tribe and then the grant. So when individuals first come to our program, I think I mentioned earlier that a lot of times we send them to inpatient treatment.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually covered by the tribe. The individual has to sign essentially a contract saying that if they leave that treatment, then they're going to have to pay it back themselves. So it's incentive to make sure that they stay there versus, you know, requiring that they stay there. And sometimes the treatment court as well, the wellness court, will require that before their admission into our program. And then once they get back, they'll start having individuals with individual AOD counseling with the mental health clinician that the tribe has employed just for solely this purpose. And she'll also hold the group sessions. Mm-hmm. And then we also have a mental health clinician that will do a lot of one-on-ones, and potentially she's going to look into some type of equine therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be utilized a lot with, I believe, the family treatment court.
Mm-hmm.
But we have two, and again, one's provided for by the grant, and then the other is provided for by the tribe. Our hopes, and the reason that we have two is we think that the separate mental health clinician would really assist some type of the co-occurring disorders.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Michael.
Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. The community element of the program is incredibly fascinating, and I really appreciated how much time you spent talking about that, because it really feels like and seems like such a crucial element and a distinction in tribal courts as compared to county courts. I appreciated that you talked so much about that. So is participation solely for Ho-Chunk members, and do they need to be enrolled, or can it include descendants?
We have not had any descendants apply yet. I think that would be handled on a case-by-case basis. As of right now, it is solely for tribal members, but our community members are open to this. For instance, in July, we had our annual sobriety social dance at the Foundation Hollow Grounds, and we invited all of the community to that. We're holding another sobriety social dance in September of this next month. That will also incorporate that. But then we're going to try to come up with perhaps some different cultural activities that, again, the general public will be available to participate in. We're hoping to have maybe moccasin games, something that, you know, is traditional culture that our participants in the community can participate in.
Thank you.
Anything else? Go ahead.
Do you have a heroin problem in your area?
By virtue of my other cases, I would say yes. Do we have anybody with a heroin issue currently in our treatment program? No. I think that it's something that's relatively new to our area, or perhaps is just being really dealt with in our area, but I don't have currently any participants that have utilized that. Now, we have participants that have indicated that they utilize Molly, and I don't know if that is heroin or it's a specialty drug that's similar to heroin. So we have had that.
Thank you.
Joanne.
Hi, I was wondering about if you're looking at historical trauma when you're working with these folks in their treatment. One of the things that really impressed me with Eau Claire Courts was there linkages in the treatment to understanding trauma and understanding the effects of trauma, especially when it comes to addiction and mental health issues? And I know that when we're talking about, you know, Native American Indian nations, that there's often that underlying, you know, historical trauma that can, you know, sometimes be the cause of the struggles that folks have. And when you're talking about, you know, addictive behaviors and people moving from one addiction to another, what are they getting education and treatment around, you know, historical trauma and developmental trauma?
Yes. Our mental health clinicians have been trained regarding historical trauma. And, you know, I kind of made a joke earlier that they didn't want to leave because of the incentives. But I do believe that it's because they're dealing with some pretty significant issues that may be historical in nature that are being addressed by mental health clinicians. And certainly they have their own rules of professional conduct that they need to adhere to. But sometimes it'll be like, Judge, this individual just needs a little bit longer. I know you want them to get through the program, but I just want you to know that we're dealing with something here. And oftentimes I'll sort of back off and be like, okay, I guess I won't ask them to phase up tomorrow. But figuring out how it is I can get them to move through. Historical trauma is definitely outside of my comfort zone. You know, I've actually received training on it, but I have no idea how people deal with that. And I know it's so individualized that I'm not really sure how I can push that along as a judge to ensure that they graduate our program. The best that I can hope for is that our mental health clinicians are utilizing that, and then if a participant has some type of issue, then it'll be brought to my attention.
Okay, well, thank you very much for taking your time to be here with us. It is very interesting on how you're working your program in Jackson County.
Thank you.
Okay, we're... we'll have a schedule, but we'll go to the description of materials distributed.
Yes, we have prepared two memos for the committee, and I think given that the shorter one is the one that describes the mental health court evaluations that Melissa has found, we thought we'd go with that one first and then move into a discussion of the options memo after that. So Melissa will go first.
Sure. Memo number two, response to a request made at the last committee meeting for information on research that has been conducted on mental health courts. So what I did it for you is I provided two links. One is to, I don't necessarily want to call it a meta-analysis, but it's about as close as you can get to a meta-analysis of looking at various types of research done on mental health courts, both talking about the structure of how these courts are organized, as well as the evidence that's evaluated by mental health court evaluations. So it kind of breaks everything down. The second link has a list of individual research analyses that have been conducted. So you can see, if you just glance down, a lot of the evaluations have been done on individual courts, and they have not really been either nationwide or statewide, for example. So the best that I was able to find was this research document for you.
The second document is memo number one, and this summarizes options that have been suggested throughout the time that the committee has met by various speakers, and also individual members had submitted certain items to me. Now, one thing to maybe discuss before we go into this is that at this point in time, we do not have a quorum. We only have 8 people here, and we need 9. This afternoon, we expect to have 9, but I believe we can probably start going through this, but in terms of, you know, just have a general discussion, but anything that might require a decision or vote, I think we'd have to defer until we have a quorum.
Okay.
Does that sound okay?
Yes.
All right. Okay, if everyone has this in front of them, I would like to note, too, that attached to this memo are two versions of actually the same bill draft that I received from committee members. LRB 2614, we have the slash P1, which is the first version, and the slash P4, which is the most recent version. And throughout the description of options, I will refer to certain portions of that, depending on what the suggestion relates to. So the first topic in the memo relates to treatment court coordinators. And I did provide some background on what we currently have in Wisconsin. We do have a treatment court coordinator within the Director of State Court's office. And we've heard from her, Shelley Cern. The funding for that position expires in 2015, and the memorandum lays out what the current responsibilities are of that treatment court coordinator. It's really the position that provides statewide technical assistance and coordination to all of the treatment courts that do exist throughout the state, and assists with things like educating communities about grant opportunities, and also assisting with writing grants, training, evaluation, and working on standard setting for courts. Additionally, we did hear from some counties that have their own coordinators, and that tends to be the larger counties. However, at the last meeting, we did also hear from an individual in a smaller county, specifically Calumet County, where they did not have a coordinator, and she described some of the impediments to their court because there was not a person that could touch base with all the different treatment team members and coordinate their efforts. So two of the options that were submitted for committee discussion were, first of all, providing permanent state funding for the statewide treatment coordinator position, and then secondly, providing some funding opportunities for local treatment court coordinators.
Keep going, and we'll go to discussion then after lunch.
Oh, okay. The second item in the memo is relates to criminal justice coordinating councils, and the background section describes Governor Walker's executive order that created the state criminal justice coordinating council. That was done in 2012. This is a 20-member CJCC. It's co-chaired by the Department of Corrections Secretary and the Attorney General, and staffed by various state, county, and local individuals, and supported by the Department of Justice. The CJCC analyzes the state criminal justice system and makes recommendations for its improvement. And specifically, among other things, there is a charge in there that the council should assist the governor in directing, collaborating, and coordinating services of state and local governmental agencies and non-governmental entities to increase efficiencies, effectiveness, and public safety in the criminal justice system, and make recommendations to improve the system policy operations and outcomes. And there is also a specific mention of researching and disseminating information about effective criminal justice strategies employed at the county level, including treatment alternatives, diversion initiatives, and specialty courts. So the state CJCC did establish a subcommittee called the Problem Solving Court Subcommittee to respond to this directive in the executive order. And that Problem Solving Court Subcommittee coordinates with the Director of State Court's offices and also supports local CJCCs. It assists in establishing treatment courts to meet the needs of county systems and makes federal grants under the Byrne Justice Assistance Program available to local CJCCs, which provides partial funding for the operation of those local CJCCs. And those local CJCCs have been developed to initiate improvements in the local system, such as establishing problem-solving courts on the local level, utilizing risk assessment tools and decision-making and offender placement, and creating community service programs. Currently in Wisconsin, it was reported that approximately 50 of the 72 counties operate county CJCCs. The options are, first, to codify the state CJCC into statute to ensure its permanent status. And in the slash P4 version of the LRB draft, that was actually done, and that can be seen in sections 1 and 5 of LRB 2614/P4. And also, another option was to create a position within the Director of State Court's office to help additional counties start CJCCs. The next topic is relates to adhering to evidence-based practices to establish an information clearinghouse and a certification process for treatment courts. And the background section goes through the 10 key components that we have discussed at several different meetings that have been developed by the National Association of Drug Court Professionals. And research has shown that courts that adhere to those 10 key components have a greater likelihood of positive outcomes for participants. And in addition to that, the WATCP's Standard 1 also provides that treatment courts should adhere to evidence-based practices, and the ones that are noted as principles for offender supervision in treatment courts are laid out on page 4. The options under that provision are to, first of all, create a state-administered certification process whereby problem-solving courts can be certified as adhering to recognized evidence-based standards, and second, to establish a state-level clearinghouse or perhaps multiple clearinghouses at the judicial district level for counties to gain access to information on evidence-based practices. The next topic is statewide training of treatment court personnel. We did hear from several speakers about the importance of training and noted that court staff have varying levels of access to training. A lot of that depends on, again, the size of the county and how many people are involved in the treatment court, and of course funding for attending trainings. The National Center for State Courts reports that in Wisconsin, most treatment court teams have at least one member with training, but only a few have more than one member who has received sufficient training. And it often falls upon the treatment court coordinator in a county to train the other team members. Some counties have managed to develop a mentor relationship with another court that has a longer standing treatment court. The WATCP treatment court standards do emphasize the importance of training and stress the importance of providing training before starting the court. We did hear about this at the last meeting about how there needs to be kind of a startup period of time before the grant funds kick in so that people can hit the ground running when they actually start receiving their funding for their court. And there also there was an emphasis on the importance of continuing education for team members, and a description of what some of the current training opportunities are: the WATCP holding an annual statewide training conference, and also the availability of a special projects manager in the Director of State Court's office that does provide some support for training activities. And the options that were suggested were, first of all, maintaining the special projects manager position in the Director of State Court's office to support training efforts for county treatment court personnel, and secondly, to provide additional statewide funding to enable treatment court personnel to attend trainings and to defray training program costs. The next topic is evaluation. We did discuss that at length. We heard from Kit Van Stel at the last meeting, and she described her evaluation of the TAD program. The key components from the NADCP do stress the importance of evaluation to keep measuring whether program goals are achieved and whether the programs are maintaining their effectiveness with the participants. The last Biennial Budget Act did provide for an evaluation of the Treatment Alternatives and Diversion Program, that specific treatment court program, every 2 years. Prior to that act, evaluations were funded from TAD revenue other than the Justice Information Surcharge, and Act 20 eliminated that restriction. So now the funding from that surcharge can be used to fund evaluations. And options that were suggested included continuing funding for TAD program evaluations, especially in light of TAD program expansion, and also to provide funding for evaluation of other treatment courts besides the TAD program. The next topic is the violent offender eligibility provision. We've heard several people mention this. Current law prohibits participation of violent offenders in TAD. And then on the top of page 6, the definition of violent offender is set forth. If the person meets one of these two criteria, they are not eligible for TAD. First, the person has been charged with or convicted of an offense in a pending case, and during the course of the offense, the person carried, possessed, or used a dangerous weapon, used force against another person, or someone died or suffered serious bodily harm. The second exclusion is the person has one or more prior convictions for a felony involving the use or attempted use of force against another person with the intent to cause death or serious bodily harm. And the options that were suggested are first, to eliminate the violent offender prohibition from the current TAD statute, or just eliminate the first violent offender provision that relates to violence that was used in the current charge that the person is charged with before the court. And the two drafts that are attached to the bill, to the memo, set forth these in two different ways. LRB, the slash P1, eliminates both of those provisions, and the fourth version, slash P4, eliminates the first one, where the violent offender is a person who's charged with the violent offense in the pending case. The next topic is occupational licenses for OWI treatment court participants. This is something that I believe was suggested by Judge Reddy at the first meeting, and this background provision describes generally when a person who is convicted of an OWI offense may be eligible for an occupational license, and there's different factors that affect the amount of time that the person has to wait to get an occupational license, including how many prior offenses the person had and how many within a certain time period the person had. And also, the background section points out the need for, often the need for a driver's license to attend all of the activities that are involved with a treatment court, such as getting to court on a very frequent basis, random testing, probation and counseling sessions, et cetera. And the option that was suggested by Judge Reddy and also by some members of this committee to me were that to allow a treatment court participant who otherwise might not be eligible to get an occupational license upon entry into treatment court. This would require other elements of obtaining an occupational license to remain intact, including getting an ignition interlock device installed, completing an assessment, and complying with the driver safety plan. And for the discussion this afternoon, we have copied out what current OWI penalties allow, how quickly they would allow someone to get an occupational license, and we will distribute that this afternoon. The next topic is authority to order electric monitoring as a condition of probation. This provides a little bit of background on what the current limitations are in terms of a court being able to order electronic monitoring. There has been a court case that has said that the statute seems to limit the ability of a judge to order electronic monitoring, and it seems to allow just the sheriff to do that. And the option suggested is to amend the statutes to allow the court to order a defendant to serve time on electronic monitoring rather than confinement as a condition of probation. The next item has to do with ignition interlock device information. Currently, most people that are convicted of an OWI have to have an IID installed. Currently, the companies that provide these devices are only required to send the information on IID violations to sheriff's departments. And the option suggested is to allow treatment courts to receive this IID installation information directly from service providers in addition to the sheriff. The next item is the integrated data system. Currently, the Director of State Courts Office and the DOJ are collaborating on developing an integrated data system, which will integrate the databases for TAD, the state court's performance measures, and certain federally funded programs. And the option suggested is to support the efforts of state courts and DOJ in developing this integrated data system for participant-level data for people in treatment courts, and encourages DOJ to solicit input from various stakeholders during developing this data system. The next item is incident-based reporting. The background for this describes what the incident-based reporting system is and describes it as a method of collecting data about crime incidents, including types of offenses, victim and offender characteristics, types and value of property stolen and recovered, and their and arrestee characteristics. The IBR is an expansion and enhancement of the current Uniform Crime Reporting System, which has been used for several decades, and it has been suggested that statewide implementation of IBR would assist treatment courts in more precisely classifying offenders to determine which offenders are most effectively placed in treatment courts. And the option is to pursue statewide implementation of IBR to enable better data collection. The next item is treatment court collaboration and continuing the TAD Advisory Committee. Currently, the TAD program has an advisory committee, which consists of law enforcement, judicial officers, elected officials, treatment providers, and local government representatives. And this committee has collaborated to provide a multi-jurisdictional forum for communication about TAD and assisted in developing, implementing, and evaluating the program. The committee has disseminated its findings to the local communities involved in TAD, as well as to the legislature and statewide. And the option suggested is to continue this committee and also to ensure continued collaboration among local, state, county, and national partners that has been the foundation of TAD and also other treatment court successes. The next item is treatment court system resources. Currently, judicial branch personnel, as well as other people involved in TAD and other treatment court programs, do this on top of other work that they're statutorily required to do. This could result in an adequate time to devote to treatment court activities and also to follow up with responsibilities to participating offenders, which may result in jeopardizing the program's effectiveness. It was also noted in testimony that rural counties face unique challenges in implementing treatment courts due to lack of transportation, lack of treatment, and unavailability of specialized treatment court personnel, such as a treatment court coordinator, and that many counties also face a deficit of affordable housing and sober living facilities. And the option is to analyze the availability of resources available to treatment court programs and participants, which might hamper the long-term effectiveness of treatment court programs. The next item is equal access to treatment courts. We currently have approximately 25 counties in Wisconsin that don't have any treatment court services, and comments made at meetings, both by committee members and persons providing testimony, pointed out that principles of fairness dictate that all offenders in the state who meet eligibility requirements for treatment court programs should have access to those courts. And the option is to ensure equal access to treatment courts, either by ensuring that adequate programs exist in every county, or alternatively, by permitting offenders who reside in and commit crimes in counties lacking these courts to receive the services in counties that do have them. And finally, on page 10, we have a number of specific revisions to TAD that are found in the bill draft that, although no one suggested these specifically, because the bill drafts were submitted to us, we did separate those out and describe what those were. First of all, to create a definition of either the term research-based or evidence-based, because these terms are used frequently in referring to treatment courts. And the first draft, P1, defines research-based, and the second one describes what evidence-based means. Mm-hmm. Another item is to provide for tribes in addition to counties to receive TAD grants. The current law does not specifically enumerate tribes as an eligible entity to receive the funding. Providing for the Department of Justice to collaborate with other agencies or the CJCC to maximize the impact of funded projects. Expand the population serviced by TAD, first of all by repealing the limitation in current law that the program is designed to meet the needs of a person who abuses alcohol or other drugs, and who may be or has been charged with or convicted of a crime that relates to alcohol or drug abuse. By repealing that limitation, this would allow TAD to include mental health courts and other types of treatment courts in their funding opportunities. Another provision in the drafts requires the use of a validated risk, need, and responsivity assessment instrument to determine who is eligible to participate in the project. Another provision is to require a county or tribe that receives a grant to submit data requested by DOJ each month, and to require DOJ to annually analyze the data and prepare a progress report, which it should submit to the CJCC and make available to the public. Another point would be to require DOJ to prepare a comprehensive report every 5 years on TAD and allow it to enter evaluation contracts funded by monies appropriated for the program with not more than 10% of the amount awarded as grants. And then to recommend, the options are to recommend some or all of these provisions. And then one other point would be, in addition to these revisions, provide additional staff within DOJ to provide technical assistance and program support to TAD program sites, especially in light of recent expansion.
Thank you. Okay, we'll come back at 12:30 and we'll go through and discuss these items and take a maybe some additional recommendations, but try to make some decisions so we can move forward. So see you at 12:30.
Have you found all this interesting?
There's like a lot of new concepts, Senator.
Huh?
I don't know if
there's no.
You mentioned about
you probably have you gone to the
Waukesha? Yeah, because then people can kind of ponder what they want to do. Hi.
I apologize, but
we're down in an area where
okay.
We have well established ones.
Okay. Yeah, we've had a couple of people have things come up, so not to worry. Thanks.
Are you part of that yet, or no?
I've been to the building, but I've been
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing some interesting things. There's no doubt. Yep. Absolutely.